The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance, that is GSUGGSinsurance.com, or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated June 12, 2023, bordered in red as usual on the front cover with an inner white border, narrow, marginal, in white. A grayish-white time, T-I-M-E, in large capital lettering, is superimposed upon a red, white, blue, and gray background. There's a gray panel behind the person featured, who is Ron DeSantis, an American flag in red, white, and blue, to his right, to his left, on a Florida state flag in red and white, I guess. That's all I see here, with the great seal of the state of Florida on it. Ron DeSantis has brown hair, combed neatly back, brownish-grayish-green eyes. He's looking, not pleased, but not angry at the camera, wearing a dark blue suit, white shirt, and silver-gray tie, and peeling an orange. First of all, the last page in the magazine is what I will read first. 8 questions. This is by Alana Samuels. The subject answering the questions is Satya Nadella, S-A-T-Y-A, space, N-A-D-E-L-L-A. Satya Nadella, the man who has helmed Microsoft since 2014, talks AI, jobs, and the case for developing the new technology, despite growing concerns. 8 questions. Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. What is, and this is the question, what is one unintended consequence of AI that regulators should watch out for? May I add an editorial comment here? AI that is used as an acronym throughout this magazine is artificial intelligence. Answer bias. One of the key things is to ensure that when you're using these technologies, that by some unintended way, biased outputs are not causing real-world harm. Question, what is going to change in the workplace with the adoption of AI? Answer, AI is moving from being autopilot to being a co-pilot that helps us at our work. You put the human in the center, then create this tool around them that empowers them and takes the drudgery away from work. How much time do we spend just coordinating, and how much time do we spend creating? Which is what gives us real joy? If we can tilt that balance towards more creativity, we will all be better off. Question, what are you doing to address concerns about job loss? Answer, one of the things that I am most excited about is how AI democratizes access to new skills. That will be a massive increase in total developers because the barriers to being a software developer are going to come down. Question, would you agree to any limits on use of AI for military applications? Answer, we've always said we want to make sure the best technology that Microsoft has is available to the very institutions that protect our freedom. Question, what is your response to calls to put on the brakes on training new AI? Answer, there are 2 sets of things that are important for us to have robust discussions about. The first one is here and now. How are the real-world consequences of any AI being deployed? Second, how to make sure any intelligence system we create is in control and aligned with human values. But ultimately, it is for the regulators and the governments involved to make these decisions. Question, there is an argument that the developers behind AI don't even quite understand the results that AI is generating. Should that give us pause? Answer, I think we should not abdicate our own responsibility. It is a mostly stochastic complex system using random and probabilistic elements. There are many stochastic complex systems we deal with. We characterize them using lots of other evaluation tests and make sure they're safely deployed. So it is not the first time we're dealing with complexity in the real world. We see it in biology, environment. Question, we just observe systems like biology. We created AI. Should that make us more cautious? Answer, the genesis of the computer industry was creating tools for the human mind so that we can do more, understand more, so creating technologies that allow us as humans to be able to increase our knowledge, do science, help the human condition, is the core to enlightenment. And so therefore, trying to say now is the time to stop does not seem the right approach. Question, there seems to be an urgency to make sure we are using AI to the best of our abilities. What is driving that? Shareholders? The research community? Executives at Microsoft? Answer, the world's economic growth has stalled. The last time economic growth could be attributed to information technology was when PCs became ubiquitous. If we really have a goal that everybody in the world should have economic growth and it should be climate positive, we need to build new technology that achieves both those goals. That is why I think AI is exciting. What if we can have that type of economic growth that we enjoyed in the early parts of the 20th century? But this time around, it's much more even, not just in the West Coast of the United States, but everywhere in the world. That's a beautiful world that I aspire towards. The subject of this article, Satya Nadella, is young-looking. I don't know how young he is. He's wearing a very dark, possibly black sweater. His head is bald, or perhaps it's been shaved. He's smiling broadly at the camera with dark eyes behind dark-framed glasses. Attending to the cover story now, the Florida Project. Strongman Governor Ron DeSantis transformed the Sunshine State. Can he sell his blueprint to the nation? By Molly Ball, Tallahassee. This is a very long article, so I will be abridging it. There's a photograph here, full page in color. DeSantis launched his presidential campaign May 24, photographed by Tom Williams. It's the same man who's on the cover, but he's wearing a different color tie this time. Dark, bright red, dark blue suit, white shirt, same brushed back brown hair, same green, gray, brown eyes, and again, not really a smile and not really a frown. I'm going to describe it as a smirk, but maybe that's not adequate. It is a Tuesday morning in Tallahassee, and a wood-paneled hearing room at the Florida legislature is packed. The state Senate's Fiscal Policy Committee is considering a bill to prohibit most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, and dozens of citizens have lined up to testify. Anguished young students in colorful hair and abortion is health care t-shirts. Little old ladies wearing cardigans and crosses. For hours they speak in emotional terms as the senators listen. Yet an air of inevitability hangs over the proceedings. Governor Ron DeSantis, and that's spelled capital D, small e, capital S-A-N-T-I-S, the latter five letters in lowercase, supports this bill, and therefore it is destined to pass. In Tallahassee these days, what the governor wants, the governor gets. It is DeSantis who welcomed this fight, DeSantis who called the shots, DeSantis who will reap the credit or blame for his latest move in a frenzy of right-wing policymaking. His dominance is hard to overstate. From school board meetings to the Walt Disney Corporation, the shelves of elementary school libraries to local mask ordinances, everything bears his stamp. Having shepherded his state through the COVID-19 pandemic, bucking the political and medical establishments to follow his own read of the data, DeSantis has manipulated levers of power to enact a sweeping agenda. The week I landed in Tallahassee, he signed an expansive school voucher law and a measure investing more than $700 million in affordable housing. The legislature was hearing his proposed ban on gender-affirming health care for minors, a bill to expand gun rights that would allow concealed carrying of firearms without a permit, another that would dramatically curtail union rights, a bid to prohibit socially conscious investing. All would eventually pass. At DeSantis' behest, legislators this year also eliminated diversity programs at public universities, made it easier to sentence criminals to death, and barred schools from using trans students' preferred pronouns. For a typical Republican governor, any of these policies might represent a signature achievement. For DeSantis, they are the latest line items in an agenda he calls Florida Blueprint. We have had conservative leadership in Florida for the past 23 years, but we have passed more conservative bills in the past 2 years than the previous 20, and more this year than the past 22, says GOP State Senator Joe Gruters. It is a rocket ship, a steam engine. Out of a combination of fear and mutual interest, legislators have put aside their own pet projects to do DeSantis's bidding, passing bills to shield his travel records from the public and allow him to run for president without resigning the governorship. They have also been enlisted to clean up his messes, retroactively legalizing his migrant flights to Martha's Vineyard last year, and attempting to restore state control of the special tax district around Disney World amid the company's feud with DeSantis over LGBTQ rights. This governor has used all his powers to make sure everyone around him is in lockstep, says Jeff Brandis, a libertarian-leaning former GOP state senator who lost a seat on a prized committee after clashing with DeSantis over fiscal issues. By operationalizing the culture war into a set of concrete policies, DeSantis has transformed the nation's third most populous state. What was once the butt of jokes about gators and retirees is now the swaggering, southern-tinged free state of Florida, where men are men, woke is broke, and business is booming. 1,200 net new residents arrive every day. It is in the air. It is everywhere. It is amazing, says former GOP Representative David Jolly, no fan of the vibe shift. It is between neighbors. It is when you go to restaurants, when you go to schools. You are on one side or the other, and people know it. A Florida native, Jolly is considering moving his family out of the state. If critics see DeSantis as a would-be authoritarian, allies see a conservative who gets things done. Many predicted his hard-charging first term in office would provoke a backlash. Instead, the opposite occurred. While Republicans across the country struggled last November, DeSantis romped to a 19-point re-election victory, the biggest win for a Florida governor in decades. What was once America's paradigmatic swing state now pulsates bright red. For the first time in modern history, registered Republicans outnumber Democrats. The people of Florida seem to like the steady hand, even if it is an iron fist. To fans, DeSantis's success proves a pugilistic big government conservatism that promises ruthless competence instead of Trumpian chaos can win broad support, including a growing share of working class and minority voters. We have shown that you do not have to do it the liberal way, and we're the envy of the nation when you look at our results, says State Representative Randy Fine, F-I-N-E, a Republican who has sponsored some of DeSantis's most controversial legislation and may soon be rewarded with an appointment as a university president, despite no background in academia. DeSantis says what he's going to do, and he does it. People like that, even if they do not agree with him. The blueprint has already done more than just make DeSantis the darling of the right-wing media and donors. It has changed the face of American politics. His gerrymandering of the state's political map added enough red seats to secure the U.S. House of Representatives for the GOP last November. Fellow governors invited by DeSantis to policy summits where they study his approach have enacted laws modeled on his policies, affecting millions of lives beyond Florida. And his agenda has set the stakes for the 2024 presidential primary. Donald Trump's campaign has been notably more focused on transgender issues, education, and wokeness than on tax cuts and vaccine development that might be considered his main presidential accomplishments. May 24, DeSantis officially launched his presidential campaign, instantly becoming Trump's chief rival for the Republican nomination. Trump has attacked him relentlessly, denting DeSantis's standing with GOP voters and sowing doubts about his national viability. But those who have witnessed DeSantis operate say it would be foolish to count him out. He is not charming, says GOP State Representative Fiona McFarland, but he is a terminator. DeSantis's methods of keeping the legislature in line are not subtle. At one point, a Republican lawmaker was planning to oppose a DeSantis-backed bill till he got a phone call from the governor who had helped the lawmaker get elected. Without preliminaries, DeSantis barked into the phone, "Do you know why you're here?" "Yes," the startled lawmaker answered. Without saying another word, the governor hung up. Two people familiar with the incident told me. Message delivered. Unlike his predecessors, DeSantis does not roam the halls of the Florida State House and spends little time in his office in the legislative building. The office, situated on the ground level, has become code for DeSantis, Politico recently reported. That is Plaza's bill, lawmakers will say. DeSantis, 44, was born in Jacksonville and raised in the Gulf Coast city of Dunedin, where his mother was a nurse and his father installed Nielsen TV rating boxes. A book-smart introvert and talented baseball player, he graduated with honors from Yale University, where I knew him slightly, I referring to the author of the article, Molly Ball, and Harvard Law School before joining the Navy. As a member of the Judge Advocate General, JAG Corps, he was stationed at Guantanamo Bay and then deployed to Iraq, where he served as legal advisor to the SEALs during the 2007 troop surge. In 2010, DeSantis left active duty and settled near Jacksonville, where he worked as a lawyer and married a local TV anchor, Casey Black. whom he met at a driving range. As the Tea Party fervor crested, he self-published a book of conservative ideas, Dreams from Our Founding Fathers, and traveled to local activist meetings to give talks and sell it. DeSantis was looking for a way into elected office, but unsure where to start, till he met two Florida consultants, Tim Baker and Brian Hughes, who'd made a specialty of electing conservative insurgent veterans. DeSantis thought he might run for state legislature or some other low-level office. The consultants persuaded him he had a shot at a Jacksonville area congressional district that had just been redrawn to favor the GOP. The 2012 primary was crowded, and DeSantis had little money or name recognition. The consultants devised a guerrilla strategy designed to tap into the new conservative zeitgeist. Casey, a local celebrity, began using her married name on television. The couple went door to door, using his advisor's data to target households with the strongest record of voting in Republican primaries. Meanwhile, his consultants, who had agreed to backload their fees, gambled by spending nearly all the campaign's meager budget on an ad on Fox News. DeSantis began to close the gap on his more experienced rivals. He impressed national right-wing groups and won the endorsement of the influential Club for Growth, which brought a flood of cash from donors. He won the seven-way GOP primary by a wide margin, drawing nearly 40% of the vote. Buoyed by his success, the consultants drew up a plan to raise DeSantis' profile as he headed to Washington. But the candidate dismissed them. He did not want to spend more money, with his election to Congress all but assured. It was only when Baker and Hughes expressed concern that the dispute might become public that DeSantis relented, according to two people familiar with the episode. Their role in his early career is not mentioned in DeSantis's new memoir, The Courage to be Free, which describes the door-knocking strategy as if it were DeSantis's own idea. He has a habit of rewriting history, one of the people familiar with the episode told me. There is Richard Petty, there is Tom Petty, and then there's Ron DeSantis Petty. Over three terms in the House, DeSantis was a reliable conservative, not known for his people skills. Congressional colleagues describe him as strikingly aloof, rebuffing or ignoring friendly overtures and wearing earbuds to avoid conversation. A co-founder of the right-wing Freedom Caucus, DeSantis in his memoir describes his years in Congress as mostly frustrating. GOP leaders exercise top-down power, he argues, but were not willing to fully use their leverage to achieve conservative goals. He does, however, tout his work on the Puppies Assisting Wounded Service Members PAWS Act, which funded a program providing service dogs to veterans with PTSD. In 2016, DeSantis briefly ran for the U.S. Senate seat that Marco Rubio vacated to run for president, but dropped out when Rubio decided to return to the Senate. Instead, DeSantis announced a run for governor in 2018. It was another insurgent campaign. The Florida GOP establishment already had its hand-picked candidate, Adam Putnam, State Agriculture Commissioner. But DeSantis again read the changing currents of the GOP. He appeared relentlessly on Fox, emerging as a reliable defender of Trump, particularly on the Russia scandal that enveloped the first years of the president's term. December 8, 2017, DeSantis and a fellow right-wing Florida congressman, Matt Gaetz, hitched a ride on Air Force One to a Trump rally in Pensacola. Along the way, Gaetz urged the president to endorse DeSantis for governor. He described Putnam as a never-Trumper and read aloud a list of negative things Putnam had said about the president. A couple of weeks later, after catching another DeSantis appearance on Fox, Trump endorsed him on Twitter. DeSantis made the most of it, mentioning Trump 21 times in his first debate with Putnam and running an ad that jokingly showed him reading The Art of the Deal to his young children and building the wall with toy blocks. In the general election, DeSantis faced Andrew Gillum, the progressive black mayor of Tallahassee. In an early post-primary appearance, DeSantis said, "The last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by trying to embrace a socialist agenda." Democrats decried his verbiage as a racist dog whistle. DeSantis refused to back down or apologize, but while many national observers remember that controversy, in Florida, the campaign mostly focused on state issues. What Ron said to me in 2018, when we were laying out the strategy, was, "We are going to nationalize the primary and localize the general," Gates tells me. The plan was to run against Putnam on national issues and then paint Gillum as in the pocket of Big Sugar. In a good year for Democrats, DeSantis defeated Gillum by less than half a percentage point. Trump has claimed credit for DeSantis' rise, but one former DeSantis advisor says the governor sees his success as foreordained. He has a providential belief that he'll talk sincerely about. He believes he's exactly where God planned him to be at all times, the advisor says. I am sure he believes it was nice of Trump to help me kick the SH space T out of Adam Putnam, but it would have happened anyway. That lengthy article by Molly Ball with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Julia Zorthian was considerably abridged. The Florida Project. Under the banner technology, the AI detente, the world must figure out a way to deal with the threat from AI, by Ian Bremmer. Bremmer is a Time editor-at-large and president of Eurasia Group. The now surging development of artificial intelligence will produce medical breakthroughs that save and enhance billions of lives. It will become the most powerful engine for prosperity in history. It will give untold numbers of people, including generations not yet born, powerful tools their ancestors never imagined. But the risks and challenges AI will pose are becoming clear, too, and now's the time to understand and address them. Here are the biggest. The health of democracy and free markets depends on access to accurate and verifiable information. In recent years, social media has made it tougher to tell fact from fiction, but advances in artificial intelligence will unleash legions of bots that seem far more human than those we have encountered to date. In China, and later in its client states, AI will take facial recognition and other tools that can be used for state surveillance to exponentially higher levels of sophistication. This problem extends beyond our institutions because the production of generative AI, artificial intelligence that generates sophisticated content in response to prompts from users, is not limited to big tech companies. Anyone with a laptop and basic programming skills already has access to AI models far more powerful than those that existed even a few months ago and can produce unprecedented volumes of content. This proliferation challenge is about to grow exponentially, as millions of people will have their own GPT running on real-time data available on the Internet. Artificial intelligence can also exacerbate inequality within societies, between small groups with wealth, access, or special skills, and those without, as well as between wealthier and poorer nations. AI will create upheaval in the workforce. Yes, technological leaps of the past have mainly created more jobs than they've killed, and they have increased general productivity and prosperity, but there are crucial caveats. Finally, the AI revolution will also impose an emotional and spiritual cost. Human beings are social animals. We thrive on interaction with others and wither in isolation. Bots will too often replace humans as companions for many people. And by the time scientists and doctors understand the long-term impact of this trend, our deepening reliance on artificial intelligence, even for companionship, may be irreversible. This may be the most important AI challenge. Challenges like these will demand a global response. Today, artificial intelligence is regulated not by government officials, but by technology companies. The reason is simple. You cannot make rules for a game you do not understand. But relying on tech firms to regulate their products is not a sustainable plan. They exist mainly to make a profit, not to protect consumers, nations, or the planet. Especially with a technology they admit they do not fully comprehend. So, where are the solutions? We will need national action, global cooperation, some common sense collaboration from the U.S. and Chinese governments. But all will have to make rules in coming years that limit the availability of AI bots. That's BOTS, to undermine institutions, markets, security. That means identifying and tracking bad actors, as well as helping individuals separate real from fake information. Unfortunately, these are big, expensive, complicated steps that policymakers are not likely to take unless they are faced with AI-generated but real crises. Unlike on climate change, the world's governments have not yet agreed that the AI revolution poses an existential cross-border challenge. Here, the UN has a role to play as the only institution with the convening power to develop a global consensus. By forging agreement on which risks are most likely, most impactful, and emerging most quickly, an AI-focused equivalent to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change can regularize the production of state of AI agreements that drill ever closer to the heart of AI-related threats. There could also be an agency modeled on the International Atomic Energy Agency to help police AI proliferation. That said, there is no way to address the fast metastasizing risks created by the AI revolution without an infusion of common sense into relations between the U.S. and China. After all, it is the tech competition between the two countries and their lead tech companies that creates the greatest risk of war. Particularly as AI plays an ever-growing role in military weapons and planning, Beijing and Washington must develop and sustain high-level conversations about emerging threats to both countries and the world, and how best to contain them. Again, that was written by Ian Bremmer. From Time Off, a couple of items. Time Off opener. Staying Power by Nicole Chung, C-H-U-N-G, who is a Time contributor and the author of A Living Remedy. After years of printing comics at Kinko's and selling them at conventions and local shops, Gene Luen Yang did not expect his 2006 graphic novel, American, Born Chinese, to get the attention it did, blending the coming-of-age journey of Jin Wang, the son of Chinese-American immigrants, with the adventures of characters from the Chinese epic Journey to the West. The best-selling book was a National Book Award finalist and won the American Library Association's Michael L. Prince Award for Excellence in Young Adult Literature. Yet, despite its success, a screen adaptation was not a goal for the author. I don't think there was a lot of interest in shows with Asian American protagonists back then, Yang tells me. The Margaret Cho-led All-American Girl had been canceled in 1995 after one season, and networks had hardly rushed to pursue other shows centering the experiences of Asian Americans. Plus, he had his own doubts. He thought it would be hard to effectively adapt and translate the edgiest of the book's three storylines, in which he has a character called Chin Ki embody various racist anti-Asian stereotypes in an attempt to illustrate how harmful they are for a TV audience. Then a few years ago, he met Melvin Marr, a producer whose credits include the ABC sitcom Fresh Off the Boat, who in turn introduced him to Kelvin Yu, a producer and writer, Bob's Burgers, who also appeared on Aziz Ansari's Netflix series Master of None. Yang says Yu understood the challenges of bringing the graphic novel to life on screen and also had ideas about how to expand the story and cast, address the difficult plot line, make sure the show could resonate with a new generation. Marr, Yu, and Yang are now among the executive producers on American Born Chinese, a new family-friendly series that premiered May 24 on Disney Plus and is directed by Lucy Liu and Destin Daniel Cretton. Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Yu, the showrunner, explains both the television production landscape and viewers' expectations have shifted over the years. When I was growing up, it was a few networks trying to appeal to tens of millions of viewers, but that is not where we are now, he says. Look at what is popular on streaming. It tends to be things that are not straight down the middle. People are more willing and able to dive in. Full of stunts and jokes and mythological figures, anchored by a realistic and heartfelt family story, American-born Chinese plunges readers into worlds both like and unlike our own and resists easy categorization. It also does not seem to have to grapple with the question of whether a sizable American audience will watch or understand a show about an Asian American family, perhaps because that question has been answered by shows like Fresh Off the Boat, which ran for 6 seasons. Some previous shows about Asian Americans, and there aren't many, right, were sort of forced to deal with certain aspects of the experience because nobody had ever done it before, Wang says. Ours is one of the first shows about an Asian American experience that feels like it can just have fun. American-born Chinese is nothing like Everything Everywhere All at Once, yet the projects share more than cast members. A sense of playfulness and creative freedom permeates both. Yu says one of the lessons he took from working on Master of None is that an audience will respond when creators are laser-specific about an experience. American-born Chinese is a product of many individuals' experiences. Yu based Jin's parents on his own, and the character of Freddie Wong on one of his first acting roles. The set designers took inspiration from their family's homes for the Wang's house. If you make something true, something you like, something that makes you laugh, if you do all that and other people don't like it, you can sleep at night, Yu says. What you could not live with is if you pandered to what you thought an audience wanted. I was in my 20s when I first encountered American-born Chinese. It was only the third or fourth graphic novel I had read at the time, and I remember being first charmed and then drawn into the imaginative world of the book, though I was outside its target age range, and my upbringing as a Korean-American adoptee bore little resemblance to Jin's. Asian American characters were scarce in the books I had read growing up. When I did find us, we were often stereotypes or sidekicks. But I'd always wanted to believe there was an audience for stories focused on our lives, our families, our histories. I wanted to help write those stories, and I also wanted to read more and more of them. I still do. If it is slightly easier to find them now, it is in part because readers and viewers continue to demand more. It is a privilege to get to elevate so many talented people. It is a time for us to flex, you tells me. That's why you. The door has cracked open and the responsibility is now ours. What are we going to do with it? Yang is gratified to know the comics he once drew and stapled by hand have become a foundation on which others can build their own Asian American stories. Now that his book is a show, the collective work of so many, his creation is no longer a me story, he says, but an us story. He hopes viewers will reflect on whatever part of their lives makes them feel like an outsider and learn to see that as a gift. It is a point echoed by Kwan. We all work so hard to find ourselves, our identity, and sometimes we want to be like others. But there's a beauty in being who we are. We all need to give ourselves a little more love. Nicole Chung wrote this, and it has been briefly abridged. Time Off Movies. This is an essay. Johnny Depp at Cannes was a spectacle of his own making by Stephanie Zakarik, Cannes, France. There's a photo here. It's mostly in black and white, but there are sepia tones as well. It's actually an image of three images of Johnny Depp, a young Johnny Depp wearing denim, long hair at the left. At the right, a more serious-looking Johnny Depp in what looks like a period costume. His hair is full and brushed back. And in the center, the sepia-toned, elder-looking Johnny Depp, again with long hair but straighter, stringier, facial hair, and a loose-fitting, unconventional-looking dark jacket, vest, and white shirt. The aging process is kind to none. And that includes Johnny Depp. May 16, Depp was in Cannes to walk the red carpet for the festival's opening night film, Mai Wen's Misunderstood Mistress Extravaganza, Jeanne de Berry, in which Depp plays King Louis XV, whose devotion to his favorite extramarital squeeze brought scandal upon Versailles. When it was announced that a Depp film would be opening the festival, murmurs of Sacre Bleu were heard far beyond the kingdom, though perhaps not so much in France. The festival itself has opened its arms wide to Depp, who has not exactly been untouched by controversy in the past few years, given his involvement in two high-profile defamation suits connected with allegations that he physically abused his former wife, Amber Heard. The jury ruled that Heard defamed Depp on three counts and awarded him $15 million in damages. Depp was found guilty of one of three charges in Heard's countersuit, and she was awarded $2 million in compensatory damages. The allegations and the details of the subsequent messy trials are horrifying enough by themselves. The trollish Depp fans who took to social media to harass Heard and the women who stood by her made the situation uglier. You would have to have been cryogenically frozen through most of 2022 to have missed it, yet at the festival's opening press conference, May 15, the event just wrapped its 76th edition, Cannes chief Thierry Frémaux defended the festival's choice to kick off with the film. If there's one person in this world who did not find the least interest in this very publicized trial, it's me, he said. I don't care what it's about. I care about Johnny Depp as an actor. Frémaux's ostrich head in the sand act is disingenuous, but his last two statements entwine opposing ideas that bear thinking about. Is it possible to care about acts Depp may have committed and to care about what happens to women when they come forward with allegations of domestic violence, and also to care about Johnny Depp as an actor, a performer who at certain points of his career, if no longer, was capable of bringing us the kind of joy that we go to the movies for in the first place? Though Depp still has legions of fans who will not give up the Black Pearl for love or money, quite a few showed up in Cannes to cheer him on. Many of us who used to love him cannot look at him as we did in the 1990s. The Depp of Donnie Brasco, What's Eating Gilbert Grape, Ed Wood, Dead Man, was magnificent to behold, an actor of micro-shaded subtlety and unforced charm. Even his roles in the earlier Tim Burton movies as a somber, stammering Ichabod Crane in Sleepy Hollow, or a winsome artificial boy in Edward Scissorhands, showed layers of depth within their expressionist stylization. His translucent, silent movie star skin, eyes capable of shifting emotional colors within the space of a heartbeat. To watch him was to sink into the deepest pleasures an actor can give us. Then Depp began to hide, or allow himself to be hidden, in the bedraggled pirate ruffles and rock star eyeliner of the dismal Pirates of the Caribbean movies, and the Look at Me multi-toned pancake of Burton's exhaustingly eccentric characters. His lost boy naivete began to come off as shtick. In the Pirates movies, his googly-eyed mannerisms drove audiences wild. Why bother with acting when gimmickry will do the trick? According to the current rules of how we are supposed to view male artists accused of unspeakable behavior, it should be easier to despise Depp as a human now that it's become so hard to defend him as an actor. Righteous anger is the easiest fix for complex feelings. Even defending the artistry of a great or once great filmmaker or actor, Roman Polanski, Woody Allen, Bernardo Bertolucci, who has committed or been accused of committing a heinous act is enough to get you branded a traitor. Essayist Claire Dederer has just written a whole book about how we might think about what she calls monstrous men. It is normal to feel conflicted about artists we love or once loved, but we have somehow been conditioned to believe that even conflicted feelings are bad. God forbid we hold two or more ideas at once. I no longer have much invested in who the actor Johnny Depp is today, and I have serious doubts about him as a human being. But watching him both in Jeanne d'Arc and on the red carpet only made me miserable. Jeanne d'Arc is tastefully handsome, as well as sometimes thunderously dumb, but it is not unwatchable. My Wen plays herself plays the Countess d'Arc, painting her as the fun gal of Versailles, wearing big clown stripes, donning breeches, tromping around on horseback, and she owns a black child given to her by her paramour. But don't hold that against her. She is really nice to him. As the ruler who ostensibly adores her Depp, in some scenes his cheeks and lips monstrously rouged, almost like a garish Edward Scissorhands, merely looks like a guy who has no idea how he landed in Versailles. His lines, in French, have a waxy stiffness. His eyes look beady and glazed. This is Depp's most high-profile film in years, but it is less a comeback than a tepid lurching into a small spotlight. The photos and footage of Depp on the red carpet do not make the story any happier. He looked to be pleased by the attention, but there was also something tentative about him, as if he had lost his grip on this particular reality, the false reality of a crowd's adoration at a place like Cannes, and was very slowly getting it back. Reclaiming that false reality is likely to do Depp more harm than good. A 2018 Rolling Stone profile by Stephen Roderick, written in the aftermath of the Depp-Heard breakup, showed the actor spending much of his time locked away in a mansion fortress, guzzling expensive wine, nursing the depths of his melancholy. Depp is an adult. He is about to turn 60. He has made his own decisions and created his own problems, but I don't think anyone who truly cares about acting and actors should feel happy about what he has become. to see him looking as if all the life has been sucked out of him, not to mention the creeping jowlishness, the deepening frown lines, other physical indignities that come with getting older, is akin to watching a bird fall from the sky, though birds do not bring about their own downfall. Depp is a nest of tragedies, an extraordinarily gifted man who has most likely hurt others as well as himself. He is his own worst enemy, and no matter how loudly the crowd cheers for you, there is no valor in that. Stephanie Zakarik wrote that article. Here are a few reviews. 1, 2, 3, 4, very short. The best from Khan. Also, presumably by Zakarik, The Zone of Interest, chilling and artful Jonathan Glazer's first film in 10 years, follows a Nazi officer and his family as they build their dream life in the shadow of Auschwitz. Killers of the Flower Moon. Martin Scorsese has adapted David Grand's book about the plot to kill off rich Osage Indians in 1920s Oklahoma into a work of great poetic mournfulness. The Pot au Feu. In Ang Hong Tran's lush romance, set in 1880s France, a gourmet and the cook who works for him, Benoit Majumel and Juliette Binoche, bond for life over the joy of cooking. Fallen Leaves. Lost souls meet in Helsinki in this glorious deadpan romance from Finnish master Aki Kaurismäki. Time Off Music. Profile: Jason Isbell is finding his purpose. Isbell is Isbell, by Silas House, who's a novelist and poet laureate of Kentucky. Jason Isbell says the desire to be honest and fair is his compass. One day I decided this is what I'm going to claim as the purpose for why I'm here, he says. I think it's to leave a place a little bit better than I found it and to experience all the things I can experience. This year, Isbell is certainly experiencing plenty. He's releasing 2 albums, has a role in Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, and is the subject of an HBO documentary. Isbell, 44, broke onto the music scene with the rock band Drive-By Truckers in 2001, went solo in 2007, but his 2013 album, Southeastern, changed his career not too long after he changed his life by becoming sober. Since then, he's won 4 Grammys, become known as one of the country's leading singer-songwriters, gained a legion of devoted fans, including Bruce Springsteen and the late John Prine. Isbell is thoughtful and tender-hearted, but also decisive and tough. He listens closely and looks people in the eye when he speaks to them. Quick to laughter, he also displays keen intelligence with an expansive vocabulary. Whether he's discussing the complexities of allegory in songwriters or the worries of the modern age, those concerns are at the heart of his latest album, Weather Vanes, a collection of 13 original songs that will be released, well, were released June 9, marking his 6th studio collaboration with the 400 Unit. And here's a small inset photo of Isbell with the band, the 400 Unit. They're in a kind of a barn-looking setting with dark wooden walls and a dark wooden floor. Isbell himself is kind of blondish with a light complexion and some facial hair. He is seated in blue Levi's, light blue Levi's, a dark shirt. He's got tattoos, at least on his right arm, black boots, cowboy boots, and bass guitar on his lap. And he's surrounded by the 4 other members of the band. Some are young, some are old. A couple are in between, some with long hair, some with almost no hair, one with a hat, some in denim, some in black, and they're all just looking at the camera, chilling. I think we are all worried about the same things. We just have different ideas about how to resolve those concerns. When I am trying to tackle a big issue, if I go into it like I'm trying to tell a story, then that's hard to argue with. It is hard to argue with one person saying, "I'm scared." The album includes songs like Save the World, about a father's fears of his daughter going to school amid constant shootings. The rousing Death Wish features a narrator who, like many, loves someone suffering mental illness. There are lovely ballads, lyrics that complexify addiction. Three songs where men offer advice on ways to navigate life, which he calls a Southern tradition. One of them, Cast Iron Skillet, has already gained popularity as a single and led to Lodge molding a custom Jason Isbell skillet. Middle of the Morning is a highlight, featuring perhaps Isbell's most vulnerable vocals, wherein someone who was raised to be a strong and silent Southern man is revealing their depression. Isbell has always been open about his battles with anxiety, a theme of the HBO documentary Jason Isbell, Running With Our Eyes Closed, released in April. I believe people should be allowed to be who they want, to love who they want. I think there's a big systemic racial issue in our country, he says, and if those are the things I believe and I do not say them out loud, then I am being dishonest with myself. That article, written by Silas House, was somewhat abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.